Park, and the event was to celebrate, you know, black beauty, like all the different tones, all the various tones of, you know, the different shades of being black. And her goal is to, you know, to have a billboard of all different shades of black.
Ah, okay.
In some major cities in Portland and, you know, Beaverton, and even, I think, Salem. So that's where she did her event this summer.
Ooh, Colin, you hit something right there. I'm glad we still got a minute and a half left to go. There are black folks all over Oregon, which is so cool because, you know, whenever we hear something black, it, you know, mostly it's Portland, sometimes Salem. Salem's got a great contingent in Eugene. And when the Oregon Cares Fund, that's the big story this year, still going on. Oregon Cares Fund, $62 million set aside for black folks, individuals and families. We found out there's black folks all over this state, every little county. Kona, thank you very much. We're going to do more next year with each other, Kona. You know a lot that's going on. I'm missing out on some stuff, so we're going to keep each other up on events, for
exactly.
sure. For
very
sure.
Very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
We say goodbye to the KBOO audience. Be sure to, if you party very safe. Keep that distance. Do it at home. Zoom it up. Mike, go ahead and let's celebrate the rest of this show for a couple of seconds. See y'all next year.
Bye. Happy New Year.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Let's celebrate January 9th, 2014, at the age of 79.
This is called As a Possible Lover. As a possible lover practices silence, the way of wind bursting its early lull. Cold morning to night, we go so slowly without thought to ourselves. Enough to have thought tonight, nothing finishes it. What you are will have no certainty or end, that you will stay where you are, a human gentle wisp of life. Ah. Practices loneliness as a virtue, a single specious need to keep what you have never really had.
The Pacifica Radio Archives holds a unique collection of Amiri Baraka recordings, which we will present on this program today. We begin with a recording from 1964, when he was known as Leroy Jones. Leroy Jones' Amiri Baraka material is simply brilliant. When people think of the Beat Generation, they turn to names like Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti, and Kerouac. Most people don't know that Baraka at the time was a beat poet himself, both as a writer and as a publisher from Greenwich Village. His Totem Press, founded in 1958, published many of those poets, including Ginsberg and Kerouac. This program is historically significant for several reasons, which we will lay out throughout the program. First, though, Langston Hughes' collection of poetry entitled New Negro Poets USA, just published in 1964, featured 37 black poets, including Julian Bond, Audre Lorde, Gwendolyn Brooks, and our featured poet, Leroy Jones, also known as Amiri Baraka.
A poem called The Dance, which is really written for a poet, San Francisco poet, Robert Duncan. The Dance. Held up for me by an older man. He told me how, showed me, not steps, but the fix of muscle, a position for myself to move. Duncan told of dance, his poems full of what we called so long for you to be, a dance, and all his words ran out of it, that there was some bright elegance the sad meat of the body made. Some gesture that if we became for one blank moment would turn us into creatures of rhythm. I want to be sung. I want all my bones and meat hummed against the thick floating winter sky. I want myself as dance, as what I am, given love or time or space to feel myself. The time of thought, the space of actual movement, where they have taken up the sea and keep me against my will. I said also love being older or younger than your world. I am given to lying, love, call you out now, given to feeling things I alone create. And let me once create myself, and let you, whoever sits now breathing on my words, create a self of your own, one that will love me.
And that was Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, from the new Negro Poets USA event in 1964. The second reason why this recording is significant is because it is one of the last major readings by Leroy Jones as Leroy Jones. After Malcolm X was assassinated in February of 1965, Leroy Jones would leave his wife and two children, distance himself from the white beat poets, and relocate to Harlem, where he would undergo a personal transformation. He would change his name to Amiri Baraka, and his writing would reflect his black nationalist worldview. Even though he had changed his name to Amiri Baraka, WBAI host Charles Hobson still referred to him as Leroy Jones in this 1967 press conference recording following unrest in Newark, New Jersey from July 1967.
This is Charles Hobson reporting on the Leroy Jones press conference that was held in Newark, New Jersey. This press conference was held at the same time the Black Power Conference had a press conference in which white reporters were chased out and television equipment was damaged. Most of the black reporters in Newark were covering the Leroy Jones press conference. WBAI, along with CBS News, were the only people to record it. There's been little play in the New York and metropolitan area newspapers on this press conference. Leroy Jones, along with Ron Karanga, Rap Brown, Floyd McKissick, and other civil rights leaders, were at the press conference. We'll now hear Leroy Jones.
As most of you can see, we've issued press statements to the press. Now, the gist and core of what we will say is contained in this document. Now we will extend and broaden and comment and embroider this statement. We have witnesses here to some specific cases of police brutality and police murder. We have some specific witnesses here. But let me begin as this paper begins. We black citizens of Newark, New Jersey declare at this point that the unrest among the black citizens of Newark, New Jersey, July 12, July 17, cannot be characterized as a riot or a criminal action on the part of black citizens, although we do characterize the acts of police, National Guard, and state police as criminal acts. We understand that this unrest was a rebellion, that we black citizens want this characterized as a rebellion against the forces of oppression, brutality, and legalized evil that exists within the city of Newark, and that we citizens have the right to rebel against an oppressive, illiterate governmental structure that does not even represent our will, the will of the majority. We black people in Newark are the majority. We are over 60% of the population of Newark, New Jersey. And we will govern ourselves, or no one will govern Newark, New Jersey. Now, the roots of this rebellion are well known in Newark. Police brutality is an old thing in Newark. Also, recently, you will see in this paper incidents regarding the medical school, which is a political act against black people aimed at moving 23,000 black people from the heart of our city, registered voters, keeping those registered voters, making them live a nomadic existence so that they cannot put in a black mayor in 1970. Again, we reiterate, we will govern ourselves or no one will govern. Again, we will reiterate that throughout this conference. The medical school, 23,000 black people they wanted to move. The Callahan Board of Education situation, where Adonisio wanted to put in an illiterate political partner of his against the wills of the majority in this city. Again, irresponsibility, crassness, callousness, illiteracy characterized the city government of this city. We understand Mr. Adonisio's inability to deal with black people because black people must deal with their own problems in their own ways. We also want to use this conference to take note of the fact that our so-called Negro leaders, our Councilman Turner, our Councilman West, our Director of Health and Welfare, Larry Stalks, our Human Relations man, James Threat, our Director of Freeholders, Charles Matthews, our State Senator Hutchins Inge, that they have not supported black people, that they do not represent black people, and that they, along with Mayor Adonisio, should be recalled, that we should have a referendum that deals with the will of black people, and that every office in this city must be cleaned out and refilled with people who represent the will of the majority. Again, to reiterate our position, we are the majority. We will govern ourselves, or no one will govern. The beginning of the rebellion, Wednesday night, I think most of the superficial facts surrounding that have already been given in the press, such as they are, slanted as they are, racist as they are, controlled by the same racist murderers who are killing us on the street, are the same people who control the press. Police brutality to black citizens in Newark, as I said, is an old story. But we are able to document over 50 specific cases of police brutality, wanton murder, destruction of property by the National Guard, by police in this city. During those days, we can document it specifically. We have photographs. We have sworn testimonies, which we will send to all the media here, and we will introduce to the world at large, that we have specific proof of these things. These are not wild allegations. These are facts, and we intend to bring these facts before the majority of the peoples in the world, who also, whether you know it or not, are colored people. Under the orders, under the express orders of Police Director Dominic Spina and Mayor Adonisio, the police and National Guardsmen literally went wild in Newark. They walked down the middle of the streets firing indiscriminately into the buildings. They shot out windows in housing projects. They shot moving vehicles with no fire coming from them. In the prison, Essex County Prison, I and the inmates witnessed Saturday afternoon, the National Guardsmen and state police shoot into a slow-moving vehicle that contained two men, two women, and a child, throw the man and the woman with the child in her arms against the wall, and drag the woman out of the car who had been shot and mortally wounded. They were doing nothing but moving slowly up New Street, Newark. Later, the story got back to us that snipers did it. We also charged that most of the so-called documentation of snipers is a lie. A lie constructed by these same racist murderers to give them excuse to kill us. We also charge that the so-called allegations of outside force are just racist propaganda. The white man has never been able to understand that black people can think for themselves. So that even now, faced with the murders of our children and our women, they still think that we have to be egged on by outside agitators. You understand this? We declare now that this is a lie. That Dominic Spina is a liar where he stands when he says that the UCC and outside agitators are responsible for this violence. What is responsible for this violence, for this rebellion, is the inability of the city government to feel, as human beings, the plights of the majority of the people in this city. And that is the cause of this violence. We also say this, that as long as these unfeeling, illiterate swine continue to dominate our lives, there will be violence and there will be rebellion.
And finally, as a memorial tribute to Amiri Baraka, who passed away on January 9th, 2014, we'd like to share with you an interview that we did with him on November 11th, 2011, with journalist and author and colleague Joanne Griffith here on From the Vault. The Pacifica Radio Archives staff and From the Vault producers were privileged to invite Amiri Baraka to the archives, and we actually walked him down the corridors of our tape shelves and showed him the reel-to-reel tapes that were endangered and fragile, and the ones of not only him, but of his era and his friends and colleagues and poets and journalists that had also been rescued and saved, thanks to you, the listeners, and our patrons and our supporters. So here we are with Amiri Baraka visiting the Pacifica Radio Archives.
It is Tuesday, November the 15th, 2011. We're here at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, and I'm so thrilled and honored to be sitting opposite Mr. Amiri Baraka. Thank you so much for joining us on your whistle-stop tour to the West Coast, and thank you for popping in to the Pacifica Radio Archives and having a spending a little bit of time with us, which you really appreciate. I'm going to start off. We just took a little wander around the archives, the actual vault of the archives, which people get to hear the audio that's played, but very few people, only the chosen few, get to actually go in and take a look. What were your thoughts walking among those 55,000 recordings, all those voices dating back to 1949?
Well, it's a priceless piece of living history, and it made me think for some reason of a science fiction movie where suddenly some oppressive government tried to destroy all the books. So it made me think of that kind of archive would be the kind of thing that would be destroyed by some kind of purely fascist kind of government to wipe out everybody's memory so that, you know, people wouldn't, like in 1984, so that people wouldn't even remember when there was an alternative form of government. So that all of that kind of living history is so very important, particularly now when the powerful forces are trying to make a corporate dictatorship. So the best thing to do would be to erase all memory of, you know, say, the experiment of trying to get democracy and majority rule, and such an archive carries that history. And so you have to guard it and get ways to preserve it even better, you know, I think.
Which is where the public comes in. You know, we always need your help in being able to preserve
That's
those
right.
voices. And the voices of people like you, Amiri Baraka. We're going to hear a few cuts from some of your work dating back to like 1964, another cut from 1967 we may have a listen to, and Wise, we're going to take a listen to that, I think, back from 1984 or so. But I want to start with a quote I was listening to in preparation for this interview, where it's 1964, you're holding a press conference. This was shortly after the Newark uprising in 1967. July of 1967. And this is what you said, and this really stood out to me, especially bearing in mind what is happening at the moment with the Occupy movement, where you say that we citizens have the right to rebel against an oppressive, illiterate governmental structure that does not even represent our will, the will of the majority. We black people in Newark are the majority. We are over 60% of the population of Newark, New Jersey, and we will govern ourselves, or no one will govern Newark, New Jersey. And that refrain, we will govern ourselves or no one will, you repeat a number of times throughout that press conference. At that point, relating that to what is happening now with the Occupy movement, literally just as we were coming into the studio, we heard that the judge in New York has allowed protesters to go back to Zuccotti Park, even though they were evacuated. He said, no, you know, you can't do that. You've got to let them back in. What are your thoughts on the Occupy movement now, bearing in mind what you were talking about over 40 years ago in terms of we will govern ourselves or no one will? We are the majority.
Well, it's a continuum. See, there's always a contradictory waves, a contradictory elements in society. So that at one point, you're moving forward, but at the same time, there are forces moving backward, trying to hold you back. So You're talking about 1967 to say when they still had black and white signs in the South. And we were saying in Newark that that's not happening here. You see, this is while Dr. King was down there fighting, while Malcolm, who had just been murdered. But we were saying that, no, this is not going to happen here. It's not going to continue. This is it. This is over with. And however you react to that, note that there's nothing you can do to stop it. And I feel that's what the whole Occupy movement is. It's a continuation. But you see, the point is the people in the United States, even though you think America is advanced, still it's backward because they have more access to the people's minds. You see, there's more propaganda for the people. There are more diversions, you know.
What kind of diversions when you say that? What do you mean?
Well, you know, radio, television, newspaper lies. You know, the American people are more propagandized than anybody on the planet. They know less about their history and culture than most people do. They don't think so because they have, you know, kind of gadgets and stuff. But in the real world, they are programmed to see the world almost exactly the opposite as it is, you see. So what's happening now in the Occupy movement, you have another generation of people in the main who have begun to see the whole flaws in what this, the American, you know, the standard corporate-shaped image of America. They're seeing through that and they're demanding some change. And obviously, the reason is the so-called collapse, economic collapse, in which the banks stole billions of dollars. Unfortunately, our president bailed them out. When I always questioned that from the day he got in there, although even though I support him, I said, you should not bail out rich people with poor people's money. Mm. You know, there's no reason for you to take our money to help Bank of America. They're not going to give out any more loans.
And then Bank of America turns around and tries to charge us for using our own money.
That's right. That's right. No, I mean, it's just criminal enterprise, you know, the banks. And the point was, I said, if you believe in, you know, private profit, the market system, beautiful, go do that. But when that fails, don't come to us to bail you out. If it's free enterprise, go for yourself, you know. And that's, I think people are seeing too, that the banks are still not giving any loans. They're still having to stop those 6,000 foreclosures a day. You know, the powers to be support war. They not only support war, they make war necessary. Plus they outsize job. I mean, send the jobs out of the country. You know, they even take whole factories and move them out of the country. You see, you look inside your clothes, there's none of your clothes even made in the United States.
Even if you're to buy the material to make it yourself, the material probably isn't from here either.
Even Brooks Brothers sends his stuff to Canada. I couldn't believe that. You know? But, no, so I think there's a generation of people who are seeing through these things. And I think that there was some contention from some black and brown groups that these are young white people. Why should we join with them? You should join with them because you should be with anyone who wants to change the system, anybody who wants to shake it down. You understand? And I'd rather have young white people fighting to overthrow the system than attacking me.
Mm. I want to get into your body of work in a moment, but just one other kind of question on the kind of current political climate. I've been working on a project looking at the African-American response to having an African-American president.
Yeah.
And one of the refrains that comes back again and again and again is that we as black people almost have given Barack Obama, President Obama, a pass because he is black. We're not, you know, there's a paralysis of analysis. We're not necessarily holding his feet to the fire as we should. And I'd be really interested in just kind of getting your thoughts on, bearing in mind the comments that you just made, of where you stand in terms of how we, as black Americans, well, not myself, obviously, because I'm from the UK, but how black America is perhaps doing itself a disservice because we have a black president.
Well, see, it's like I said, there's two things moving at once, you see. I mean, 145 years ago, we were slaves, you see. So you can see 145 years is no time at all. So the people are still, like, in awe. That dude is black, you know. And that is a cap on our movement. In other words, that put a cap on it, like it put a cap on a salary. The fiercest liberation movement on the planet was here in the United States, you know, that and in Africa, you see. In fact, they fueled each other. Mm. The African-American liberation movement and the African liberation movement in the 60s and the 50s fueled each other, you see. So what is the wisest and the slickest thing the people that own this country could do? Give them a black president. That'll cool the Negroes out. And it did, you see. But the point is that we have to see and understand that for the good that Barack Obama is doing, and you cannot deny, to say that he has done no good and is this and this and it is pure garbage, you know, that's just garbage. You have to at the same time say, no, you don't supposed to be bombing no Libya. You're not supposed to be putting us in a situation where you're going to bomb your own homeland, you know, for the benefit of the actual colonials, Britain and France, and for these oil companies. Mm-hmm. You know, you are supposed to fight to make these rich people pay their taxes. You know, you that was good. You're supposed to do that. You're supposed to fight to transform the healthcare system. You know, and you're supposed to fight to help poor people, because most of black people are poor. You're supposed to,
some of the highest poverty rates in the United States, absolutely. The highest unemployment, plus 16%, and so on.
And you're supposed to help fight unemployment, because that's us. Fight for housing, that's us. But it's also the great majority of people. You see what I mean? But I think somehow he's made to shy away from the fact of his own blackness, in a sense. He doesn't want to be too black to alienate people who brought us over here in the bottom of a slave ship, you know, which is sometimes kind of contradictory. You have to say, don't you understand who these people are? Mm. And I can't have too much sympathy for him in terms of the hardships that he faces, that I know he does, because you wanted this job. You know, you wanted the gig, you see. So where I support you, and obviously nobody in their right mind would ever vote for that crew of imbeciles that the Republicans have. I think they're the best campaigners for Obama. But the point is, you have to do more for your constituency. Who's your real constituency? 90% black, the 60% Latinos, the 60% Asians, that group of progressive white people. That's who your constituency is, not the banks. You know, not the auto industry, you know.
But is there a point that we also have to make him do those things? Exactly. You know, it was kind of, yes, we can, yeah. Not yes, I can.
Yeah, that's right. No, we have to howl and scream, and, you know, not in the sense of trying to dispatch him to limbo, but just like your child does, if you don't feed him right away, you go, wow. You know, and that's the same thing. We're not screaming because we hate you. We're screaming because we know you're supposed to love us.
We're demanding to be fed.
Exactly.
And there's a way that's what you're... I feel hard pressed to call it a career, because I feel your work is almost a calling. It was what you were meant to do. A career is kind of what you do when you got to pay the bills and and keep a roof over your head.
You are listening to segments of our vast collection of Amiri Baraka recordings from the Pacifica Radio Archives on From the Vault. If you would like to get a copy of this program or browse the vast collection of other programs on Amiri Baraka in our archives, please visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. You can also listen to this program again at fromthevaultradio.org. And now back to the program with Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones.
How has your career, your calling, evolved? You know, you're a poet, you're a playwright, you're an activist, you speak often what the rest of us are scared to say, and you put it in such a lyrical terms. So just take us back, just as we've been in that archive looking at, you know, audio back from 1949, what is it that made Amiri Baraka, as known back then, Leroy Jones? What is it that transformed you or led you onto that path?
Well, you know, I have to say my mother, my parents, you know, because they were, you know, like any intelligent parents, See, you're not, it's just not a random direction. They're like trying to twist you to go this way and twist you that. So you sitting there eating breakfast and they're telling you the history of black people in the South. You understand? Or who got lynched when and why? Or why your grandfather's store got burned down and why they moved from Alabama to Newark and those things, you know, which always fascinated me. You always wanted to know what that life was, why they got there. And then I took piano lessons, trumpet lessons, drum lessons. They sent me to art school. You know, I used to recite the Gettysburg Address on Lincoln's birthday every year in a Boy Scout suit. My sister was a ballet dancer who danced on Broadway. So it was a shaping of yourself so that you began to see the possibilities of these things that you had learned from very early age that you loved to do. You know, and you began to see the possibility of not only doing that with your life, but of using that to help shape the lives of other people, you see. So that's what it was, and particularly being black and very early seeing the kind of injustice. You know, my mother and father and grandmother and grandfather taught me very early that these people were evil. You know, there was not any failing in ourselves, you know, that these people were evil, ignorant, you know. And so, you know, my grandmother used to always talk about ignorant crackers, jealous crackers. I mean, I heard that when I was a little boy, these jealous crackers. So you begin to, and she was saying that because they had burned down her husband's store. This was not just some random racism.
This was something personal that had happened to her. She had reason.
And concrete. They ran them out of the South, see? So I understood that even when I couldn't say it. They had taught you that.
Hmm. So, you know, it was your parents' influence, things that happened with your own family, your grandmother's stories. You know, you clearly had a clear sense of who you were.
Absolutely.
And who it meant to be. An African American,
right,
growing up at that time. But with your poetry, your early poetry, you were associated with the Beat Poets,
yeah,
and doing a lot of work with them. So how did your position, your centeredness as an African American, square with, you know, being part of the Beat Poetry movement?
Well, because I thought that, let's say, circa 1950, when I was coming out of high school, you know, I went to a high school that was 90% Italian in an integrated New Jersey town at the time, Newark. I went to college first at Rutgers. Then I left Rutgers and went to Howard University. I flunked out of Howard University because I wasn't interested in the stuff that I said. You know, you want to be a doctor. Not really.
You change your mind when you're a teenager.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know,
I wanted to be an astronaut when I was 15, you know.
Well, that's what I mean, you know. And I said, well, no, I don't really want to do that. But when I was in station, I was stationed in Puerto Rico. I was a gunner on a B-36 and spent hours and hours and hours and hours guarding airplanes, reading books. And there was a newspaper called The Village Voice that came out. And they used to talk about Allen Ginsberg and how they had busted Allen and impounded the books and how this poetry was so horrible.
Mm.
And so it fascinated me, you know. I said, oh, yeah, that's what's happening.
How can I be down?
Exactly. So when I left Puerto Rico, I went to Greenwich Village because I thought that's where the great intellectuals were. I got tricked because a lot of them were poseurs, you know, they pretended to be, but some of those people were real people. They really were, you know, Ginsberg was an actual intellectual. People might know that they have this image of some wild beatnik flying around, but Allen Ginsberg was one of the most informed people on Western poetry I have ever met, you know. So when I got into that situation, you know, naturally you have the same kind of tensions that you have in America there. But what changed me altogether from being in Greenwich Village in a largely white milieu was the murder of Malcolm X,
mm.
You see. Now, the things that happened down there when I first arrived in New York was the same time that Dr. King and him were in Montgomery fighting Westport got. Naturally, I took note of that, expressed my own feelings, you know.
And at that time, would you have defined yourself as a black nationalist then?
No,
or this comes much
not.
Later?
Just a poet.
That.
Poet, just a poet. It wasn't, I'll tell you, it wasn't until, let me see, 57, 58, Montgomery. 59, Fidel Castro. I went to Cuba in 1960. I took Langston Hughes' place and went down to Cuba. I met Fidel Castro. I met Che Guevara. I met all these young people walking around with these guns who had just taken over their own lives, you see. And so I became fascinated with that, the whole idea of revolution. See, but when Malcolm X was murdered, didn't it change from just revolution to the question of black liberation?
Hmm.
Because the murder of Malcolm X, to me, was an attack on the Afro-American people. I mean, straight out, you know. Whereas I had always known that, you understand, even the plays I started writing before Malcolm's murder suggested I understood the question of being oppressed. But what Malcolm's murder did was make me understand that being in the village in that milieu, I was isolated from the whole black liberation movement. See, and so the month
kind of writing about it from an intellectual standpoint,
exactly,
as opposed to actually
exactly,
living it.
Exactly. So the month after Malcolm was murdered, I moved to Harlem, you know, with a bunch of black people who were living in the village, and organized the black arts movement in Harlem. And the reason for that was, say, if we're going to be artists, we should, if we think that art is profound and actually has some use to the world, then it should be given to our people who are in the worst shape and need the help. And then you see the examples. See, then you could see a Kwame Nkrumah. You could see Dr. King. You could see what Malcolm's efforts were, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, and you begin to say, I'm going to be part of that. Maybe be part of that struggle. You know, this is a struggle that's real. And so the Black Arts Movement, what we said, we wanted first an art that would be clearly black-oriented, you know, that would have the culture and the whole voice of Afro-America. You know, when I used to be in the village, people would come up to me and say, Mr. Jones, I didn't know you were a Negro. But no, and then we wanted an art that would be public, out in the open, not just in these little joints like in the village. We went, so that's when we went uptown. We took it out in the street. Mm-hmm. We sent out 4 trucks a night, you know, paintings one place, set up easels on the street, musicians another place, used the back of a truck as a stage.
Can art affect change, though?
Absolutely.
How so?
That's why they use it against you. I mean, if it was free, where all art could be out with equal kind of access to the people's minds, there would be a revolution almost immediately. The great artists throughout history have always been against oppression, you know, and have always fought, you know, against it, and have always suffered because of that, you know. So for the Afro-American people, remember, at one time, they had Langston Hughes, Du Bois, Paul Robeson, all of them getting ready to try to send them to jail. They sent them all to McCarthyism and so forth. I just wrote a play about Du Bois. The FBI called him the most dangerous man in America. Here's a man, 83 years old, they call the most dangerous man in America. Because our people, our writers, our artists have always been stand up. You know, they've had to stand up to this, like Robeson's book, Here I Stand. The artist must take a stance against fascism. The artist must take a stance. Or Jimmy Baldwin, you know, Blues for Mr. Charlie, you know. Or Toni Morrison, or Margaret Walker, For My People, you know. So our tradition is clearly political, and for obvious reasons, because we need to be. Mm. You know, if you are oppressed, you need to struggle. You need to talk about it, you know. There was a saying that came from Guinea in the 60s, victory to those who struggle, you know. And that's what we saw our role. As artists, we must help in the struggle to liberate black people. We struggle for equal rights, struggle for self-determination. But we had to do that. Otherwise, what is the reason for us being arts?
Hmm. There was definitely a place for it then. You know, we've seen how people like you, Paul Robeson, and various others who've used their art and their craft to change the public consciousness. What role do you see art, poetry, drama, writing playing in people's liberation today? You know, we've seen the Arab Spring. We saw uprisings in my hometown of London. We're seeing the Occupy movement here. But what role does art and music still play? Obviously, you're a big musical man yourself, but, you know, are artists stepping in as people of your era did?
No, they have to do the same thing. See, what makes it more difficult now is that they give alleged access to colored people in the arts now that they didn't back in my early days. You know, one thing the black arts movement did is force them then to open up the film industry. Before that, most of the black people you saw on film were butlers and maids, you know. But then they discovered shortly after that they didn't have to have a bunch of black people in there. They could have one and we would still go see it, you see. But that was the kind of cap. Like I said, they used Obama to cap the movement. They used the access into the arts for a small group of people, black people, as a cap on the protest altogether.
Right.
Because, see, when the Black Arts Movement, we were marching in the street with a Sun Ra and a flags made by black artists walking across 125th Street, talking about bringing the art in the street. Because what the society itself saw, that the art we were bringing in the street was saying, this society is evil and needs to be destroyed, you see. So people always come up to me, well, how come your plays are not on Broadway? Then these people are not fools. See, if you think your enemy is dumb, you dumb. You know what I mean? It's no such thing. See, whatever you do, they're going to get a countermeasure.
Mm.
But it's up to you to be swift enough to get a countermeasure for that countermeasure. See, just like war, because that's what it is, war. If you have to listen, if your people are oppressed, but they have to listen to 24 hours or watch 24 hours of absolute lying television, racist, you know, just minimally racist, ignorant all the way, or films or plays, you know. I mean, just last year they had a play on Broadway about the Scottsboro Boys, the musical. You know, that's incredible. But they had a play called the Scottsboro Boys that Langston Hughes wrote back in the 30s, but they're not going to do that.
Right, right.
You see what I mean? So it's they're doing it right now. You know, they got a play on Broadway about Martin Luther King. They're supposed to humanize Martin Luther King, like they humanize Malcolm in Marable's book, you know, so you could see him go to the bathroom and cuss and have a drink and smoke, so therefore you know Martin Luther King. See, that's so stupid. Martin Luther King is not known because he went to the bathroom and smoked, you know what I mean? But because of what he thought and what he did.
And the fact that he died for it.
Exactly, at 39 years old, which is another point. Both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King never reached 40 years old, see?
And gone too soon. I want to, just as you mentioned there, Langston Hughes, I want to bring it back to your work. And we have some wonderful archive. We have a lot of archive material.
Yeah, I can see that.
But a lot that contains you and your work. And there's a couple of questions I wanted to ask about that. There's some work that we have of you as Leroy Jones. And then we have a stack of work of you as Amiri Baraka.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting. As I said, Leroy Jones, you kind of put your arm up. But in terms of... and this is actually more of a question for us at the archives. When we introduce your work, the older work of Leroy Jones, do you like? Are you okay for us to say this is the work of Leroy Jones, or do you would you prefer us to say
no.
Leroy Jones, now known as Amiri Baraka?
You should identify it as, you know, because it's part of a continuum, you know, and in fact, that will help some people to understand the changes in it, you know, when it was this and when it was that. So it's the same person. There are people in my hometown still call me Leroy, especially old people.
They're like, we can't get with the new name. It's like, you grew up as Leroy. We know you're
Leroy.
No, that's it.
What can I say to an old lady come across who know my mother? What am I supposed to say? Don't call me that.
She'll turn around and beat you first.
I know. No, but that's one of the things about living at home. You know, there are people there who know my family since the 20s, man. So I always, you know, I accept that. Mm. I accept that.
Was it important for you to change your name?
At the time, yeah, because we were trying to identify with the African Liberation Movement. Remember, there was Kwame Ture, Kwame Nkrumah, there was Sekou Ture, you know, these people who were actually fighting. Mwalimu Nyerere, who actually fighting to liberate the African, Steve Biko. So we wanted to identify with Africa and African revolution. And there it was, if you know your history, you know there was a time right after the Civil War when black people changed their names. Mm-hmm. But they changed their names in the main to names that were not the slave master's names,
yeah.
You know. So it was not new, but at the time, yeah, we wanted to identify with African revolution and Africa and the whole question of African culture, black culture. We wanted to state our own self's worth, you know, that self-consciousness.
How successful do you feel that was? Because I was having a conversation with some friends. You know, I'm from the UK. My family's from Barbados. You know, I have a stack of friends that live on the continent. You know, we're all over it. We're diaspora people. And there's a feeling that we as black people perhaps just don't care as much as we used to.
No.
We're not willing to put our necks out for a cause. And I'm always curious when I speak to people like you of how successful you feel, whether it was changing your name, whether it was, you know, going and spending time on the African continent. You know, how successful was it? You know, when you look at my generation and younger now, do you feel it was worth it? Do you feel that you know, what you guys were trying to achieve, you know, have we let you down?
Well, no, it's always, you know, like Du Bois said, it's the Sisyphus syndrome. You roll the rock up the mountain, they roll it back down your head. They can never roll it back down as far as it was because the people who've now gotten hip, that they ain't going back there, see. But then, remember, this wave that we're having now of backwardness, you know, even in among the white folks, where suddenly everybody... You look at our people and, you know, white women, they all want to be blondes. So you say, what is that about? Think about it, what it's about. You know, the whole thing goes backward. You know what I mean? Whereas in the 60s, we used to write poems about that. Mm-hmm. You know, take off the wig, take off the wig, take off the wig, take off the wig. But there's always an element of co-optation. Whatever you do, you know, it's like rap. They start very politically. You know, you're talking about Curtis Blow or Grandmaster Flash or early Public Enemy. When the corporations get hold of that, they turn that around.
And it becomes Lil Wayne.
Suddenly they're talking bad about your mama and your wife. You know what I mean? It's incredible. But the point is this. They can't co-opt it if you have control of it. And a people with $900 billion a year, the Afro-American people, with $900 billion a year and 50 million people, no one should be allowed to mess with you. You know, you should not prevent that. You know, nobody can make you do anything if you got control of what your resources are, you know, and you mentally focus on what to do with them. We talk about getting... reparations for slavery. And that's true. And we have to continue that struggle. But we have to remember, we already got $900 billion. You're not poor.
Right. How we choose to use it.
Well, if you had an organization large enough, strong enough, comprised of all these different ideological strands, see, then even reparations would come quicker. Because you'd be able then to direct... where that money, where that resources go, how do you combine these resources to help yourself where you need you know, jobs, housing, you know what I'm saying, education. There's enough retired Afro-American teachers to set up your own kind of Saturday schools, you know. But it's the question of focus. It's the question of purpose. You know, what is it that the people want to do? I was looking at a program the other morning. This guy, I can't think of this, Chris Rock, had this movie about hair.
Yeah, good hair.
And this woman, this is a working class woman. So she paid $1,000 for a wig. There was two of them. You say, well, wait a minute.
And it was the wig on layaway, if I'm not mistaken.
On layaway.
Yeah.
No, but you want to know, what is the basis of that? The basis of that is the whole social pressure of that, you know, of why you should do that, why you want to look this way. So there was definitely some progress made in the 60s and 70s, but it's like everything else. The rock rolls back down. You have to pick it up again. You know, you have to pick it up again. The struggle continues. Mm-hmm. You know, it's never going to be over. It's over going to be about something higher, we hope. Higher level of stuff, we hope.
But always.
We're not talking about getting out of chattel slavery, you see. So that's only 145 years ago. You got a color guy who's the president 145 years later. So it shows you've been doing something.
Mm.
But
I guess having a black president wasn't necessarily the goal of people in the movement.
No, but the point is, they wouldn't have had to do that if it wasn't for the fact that the terrible stuff that went on in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
You understand? Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were murdered. They didn't retire. Mm. And they were young men, 39 years old. You remember, those were young dudes, 39 years old. Killed both of them. So you have to see that kind of fierceness. Look at the statue of Martin Luther King in Washington now. You know what I mean? You understand
it's
what I'm
progress.
Saying? Of course, Malcolm's going to be slower.
He'll get there.
He'll get there. But the point is that kind of struggle, the ferocity of Afro-American struggle is what pushed the whole country forward.
One of the poems that kind of got you into quite a bit of trouble that people got very upset about was Somebody Blew Up America.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, when you read it, there's only one small part that actually talks about the World Trade Center, which is the bit that everybody grabs onto and gets very upset and irate and what have you about. And I'd just like to ask you about when you were writing that, just take me through your thought process when you were actually writing that particular poem and kind of, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and years down the road, kind of how you feel about that.
Well, see, I was supposed to go to New York that morning to help Felipe Luciano with his election for city council, which he did not win. I got a phone call, said, turn on the television. I turned on the television, the building is burning. The building's right across from our house. We live in Newark, New Jersey. If you go up to the third floor, you can see the World Trade Center. So while I'm looking at the television, here comes the next plane. Pa-dow. So I was scared, to tell you the truth. We were frightened because never seen that close. You can see that smoke and stuff from the house. But in the next few days and weeks, listening to Bush, I began to think, what terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. I said, but that's how we got here. What do they think slave trade was? What do they think the Klan was? Those are terrorists. We've suffered terrorism here all our lives. So you're going to tell me that this is some kind of thing you don't know? So I wrote that poem. By the end of September, I had finished it. I remember early October. I sent it around on the net. Got mostly favorable responses. And then I was named the Poet Laureate of New Jersey by this Governor McGreevy. And I tell him, I said, you must don't know nothing about poetry. You really lost. He said, I can handle it. So I read the poem at the Dodge Poetry Festival to about 1,000 people, two sets, you know. The next day I got a phone call and said, you got to resign and apologize. You got to apologize and resign, you know. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. But anyway, they said that it was an anti-Semitic poem, and I said, well, you know, you nuts. And that was the end of that. I wasn't thinking about that. But then this firestorm of newspapers, television, people in my calling me up with these hate calls and stuff like that. But the poem was correct. See, anybody who objects to that poem probably hasn't read it. You see what I mean? Because if you're going to call me anti-Semitic, there's stuff in there about the Holocaust opposing that. You understand? The question was that they did not want me to suggest that Israel knew about the raid. But not only Israel, France, England, Russia, China had told them that people were planning this. And that was my... And in terms of the thing that they really about the Israelis who were filming, that was a question that was in the New York Times and the Star Ledger. There were five Israelis on top of a truck filming the explosion. Now you want to say, well, what they do? How they know about the explosion? And was it funny to them? You know, why was it funny? They were gone out of the country in the next month.
You were doing what you've always done. You were shining a light on perhaps what people feel uncomfortable to look at or to
absolutely,
to,
absolutely.
To talk about.
And the whole thing about 3,000 Israeli workers at the Twin Towers, they have never even acknowledged that they were Israeli workers. I didn't say Jewish workers. You understand? The Jews died with us, the American Jews, in that place, in that building. I got that information from an Israeli newspaper, Haaretz. I got it from a Jordanian television station, Watan. Also from another Israeli newspaper, Aharat, was it? But anyway, Cynthia McKinney asked why had people withdrawn stocks from United Airlines and American Airlines 2 months beforehand. We wanted to know why did the largest Israeli shipping company, Israeli-American shipping company, why did they withdraw from the World Trade Center a month before the bombing and then come back later? You know, I mean, the whole thing stunk. And you cannot take a plane and fly over the United States. You think you can, try it. Especially if you say you're going to California. Now you're going to make a left turn, and you're going to go where? Among the most carefully guarded strip of land in the world, down to where? Wall Street. And you're going to bomb Wall Street? No, you're not. And then you're going to go past Wall Street and go where? The Pentagon? No, you're not. You're not going to do it. You're going to get blown out of the air. So that's what I want to know. How is it that they could do that? You see? And no matter what is said, until that stuff becomes clear and reasonable, I'll never believe it.
Just read something from one of your...
I'll read something that I can memorize from Wise. I got that title from Jimmy Baldwin. He said, anything in the world, if you ask why, if you keep asking why, you'll get wise. So that's what that is, this poem. Africa. Go back black, see yourself, touch yourself, know yourself. Africa, mighty, ancient, beautiful Africa, creator of the human being, of speech, music, dance. Africa, mighty, ancient, beautiful Africa.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. We'd like to thank Joanne Griffith, our colleague who brings our archives to the BBC Radio 5 Live on a program called Up All Night, and also author of a book, Collaboration with the Archives, Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America, published by City Lights Books. She is now working on book 2 with the Archives on the Black Arts Movement. The program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and I've also been your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Thanks for listening and remembering Amiri Baraka here on From the Vault.
Tune in to KABU on Thursday, December 31st at 8 p.m. for KABU's New Year's Eve extravaganza. Join KABU DJs as they bid 2020 goodbye and kick off the new year with positive vibes. You'll hear sets from Diablo, Top Dolla, Kabloom, and more. Again, that's KABU's New Year's Eve extravaganza from Thursday, December 31st at 8 p.m. to Friday, January 1st at 5:30 a.m. Bring in the new year here with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.